98.3 FM, KFAI, Minneapolis. I'm Al McFarland. Welcome to The Conversation with Al McFarland. I'm glad to be here and glad to have you along as well. As always, just huge kudos to the team and colleagues and partners here at KFAI. What a powerful resource, a powerful institution, a powerful medium for connecting us in community here in Twin Cities and around the world via internet. As always, we want to invite you to be a part of the conversation. And as always, we promise robust conversation in today's program. You know, but before I get into that, I want to let you know how you can connect. We're streaming live on YouTube. And if you go to YouTube Inside News MN, you can join the program, watch the program on the live stream. We're also live streaming to LinkedIn and to Facebook. On YouTube, there are two platforms, the Inside News platform and the Black Press USA platform. And either one works. We'd love to have you on board. Let us know where you are. Drop a note in the chat. Shout yourself out, your town out, your concerns out. Weigh in on the conversation. We'll try to connect with you in the process. Well, today I've got some friends and leaders in community joining me following what I think are some fairly significant challenges to communities nationwide and locally. What are you talking about? Well, in Minnesota, there's this big issue about fraud. And yes, there's been a lot of fraud documented, adjudicated in the courts. But the question is, has that air of accountability and responsibility also immobilized good thinking, right work? So I want to raise that. What's the impact of all of the allegations and even the convictions of fraudulent activity having on other organizations, particularly legacy institutions that have been doing great work and continue to do great work? And if you've got a comment or experience or story or concern about that, it's a chance for you to weigh in on the conversation. My principal guest today is one of the leaders of one of the major, both local and national organizations, the Urban League. It's called the Urban League of Twin Cities. And Marquita Stevens leads that organization. It's a storied civil rights and economic power empowerment institution. The focus areas include workforce development, housing equity, and advocacy. And we want to talk about, you know, the Urban League's historic role in Minnesota and nationally, and how this environment where the threat, the specter of the fear of, you know, lack of accountability and of fraudulent activity seems to be choking down the right things that we do in community. I ask to join me in this conversation two colleagues and youthful elders in the community. Anthony Taylor is with the Wellness Center. Justin Terrell is executive director or CEO of the Minnesota Justice Research Center. Anthony, Justin, good to see you both. And Marquita, welcome again, and thank you so much for being here. Let me start with you, Marquita. Give the people who don't know Urban League Twin Cities 101. What's the organization, the vision, and the mission? And thank you so much for being here.
Certainly, certainly. Good afternoon, everyone. Glad to be here. Certainly glad to join all of you on the panel to talk about things that are important to us as a community. The Urban League is a legacy civil rights organization that offers programming. It's a civil rights and advocacy organization dating back to 1925 in the Twin Cities. So we celebrated our 100th year anniversary last year. So we're 101 doing what we do. And most people know us for workforce and housing and education. What they don't know is that we have a pretty robust program in family stability. So one of the things that we do is work with people that are at risk, families that are at risk of child protection claims, working with kids and families to make sure that doesn't happen, engage the community in that work, been pretty successful at it. We're looking at moving into foster care as a result of the work that we've done in family stability. So we're growing, we're doing some new things that typically aren't necessarily ascribed to the Urban League, but they are ascribed to the community in which we work, in which we live, and in which we play. And so we want to be useful and a primary partner with those who do those things.
Mark, here, take a minute, if you would, to describe your own background. What's been your route to service of community and to leadership at this important institution?
It's funny you should ask me that. I was at a workshop, Bridge Builders, just this week, and a similar question was asked, and it made me reflect in such a way as I teared up. So I'm going to try not to do that this time and get it out. But to be perfectly honest with you and the viewers, it's a calling. And it's one that I have, that I stepped into many, many, many years ago. And it is taking me through great community experiences in now what now is my third city as an adult. And since I've been here, I worked as the executive director lead at the African American Adoption Agency, where we were charged with moving children from foster care into permanency. And I'm proud to say that even though we were the sole agency charged with that, we were successful in moving over 400 Black kids out of foster care and into permanency. And that's something that, you know, credit the man upstairs for. And fast forward, I worked in Roseville School District doing some community work there. And I was privileged to lead the conversation between the police in Roseville and the citizenry after the murder of Philando Castile. And so I was bridge building, you know, then as well in terms of the work, community work that I was doing. And then I came to the Urban League, and I started in Urban League in 2017, developed the Black Gems program, which is a after-school program for high schoolers and gearing them to become self-confident and self-aware so that whatever choices they make in life, they make them fully aware and bringing their full selves into it. So it's a social emotional learning thing. And then we do the HBCU tour with it and visit the civil rights sites, et cetera. And it's been very impactful and very successful with the kids that have participated in it. And then I ended up in this chair in 2023.
Let me introduce Anthony Taylor and Justin Terrell. Anthony and Justin, do the same thing, if you would. Just give people the elevator pitch on your work, your priorities right now, and then we'll get into the conversation. Anthony, you start first.
So, yeah, thank you. This is Marquita. Good to see you. Justin, good to see you as well. I think right now my very big focus is really looking at real economic measurement of success. I think I'm working really on this River North Development Partners and what we're doing around real estate development. And I'm very focused on a complementary element of development that isn't entrepreneurship, it isn't social services, it isn't nonprofits, it is that what businesses are we building that will bring 50 to 100 jobs to North Minneapolis that will pay, that require only a high school diploma, that will pay $55,000 a year or more and give a professional trajectory. And the only thing that I'm focused on is increasing median household income, increasing homeownership through that, qualifying for more mortgages. And what I really see is that getting the $55,000 for a family increases voting, it increases educational outcomes, it increases health outcomes, and that everything else is a side benefit. So I am seeing myself as aligning with everybody else who's doing this work so that we can partner in a real way. And I think it'll be, you know, as we dig into the real history, the 100-year-old history of the Urban League, I think that we will find that the Urban League 100 years ago was where we need to be today. Right. I think your conversation and the articles you've written this week, I think is going to be very interesting for us to do the analysis and realize we are returning to a moment of very serious reflection. And 1910 looks a lot like 2026.
We'll go deep into that in a few minutes. You mentioned the number $55,000 as a household income. What is the household income currently for North Minneapolis, and why is that number the signpost or the benchmark?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let me say median household income in Minneapolis is about $89,000. Median household income in the region is probably about $100,000. Median household income in North Minneapolis, if we use, we'll just say use Emerson and Broadway kind of as the center of locus, is about $39,000 a year. And we know that's a challenge. $55,000, it's probably $52,000, $56,000, I'm rounding there. We see that, talking about that as family sustaining wages. And it's a beginning. But it's a number that we've been able to measure through Brookings' work, through Raj Chetty. I don't know if you look at his big data work. We see that in this community, at about $55,000 to $60,000 a year, there is a threshold where we see those quality of life outcomes as changing, and that's why we're focused on that number.
Justin, thank you for being here, Executive Director of Minnesota Justice Research Center. You do policy research, criminal justice reform, and data-driven advocacy. You bring an analytical frame to community vulnerability and strategic responses. Tell us what your current research projects and priorities are, and give the elevator speech on mission and vision of the Justice Research Center.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for getting the name right, Al. It's like nobody ever gets the name right, but I appreciate it. And thank you for having me on to continue the conversation from last time with Anthony and obviously Marquita. You're someone that you know I love and respect, and so it's always great to be in space with you. So the Minnesota Justice Research Center is we're a small nonprofit. We're based out of Sabathany Community Center in South Minneapolis. And our mission is to transform the criminal legal system. It's no secret that the criminal legal system has had a disparate impact on our communities. It gets in the way, creates like significant barriers to some of the economic goals that Anthony is talking about. It also creates the circumstances that Marquita's work started disrupting when she began her career. And that the reality is that this system, you know, is steeped in, 400 years worth of grudges, as one of my favorite poets would say, 400 years of juries and judges with grudges against us, right? And so it is long overdue, especially considering what we've been through since George Floyd, since Philando, since Jamar, since Q the Blacksmith, and we could keep going back and back and back and back, that we transform how we administer justice in our society. And so our goal is to utilize research that is like we do our homework. We don't like to write reports for research. We don't do research for research sake. Our reports are tools. They are weapons for people to fight back against the way the system has been administered towards us from day one. Number two, we do education. And so we also consider ourselves bridge makers, bridge builders. And so we bring people together. We lead conversations across differences. We work really well with Republicans, for example. And we're constantly trying to, respect the different perspectives that people genuinely bring to these conversations and build bridges so that we can have, work towards real solutions, even though our experiences may put us in a different position to start. And then finally, we focus on policy development. So we develop policies that are data driven. We're not just coming up with the most progressive or the most conservative, whatever. Like, we don't think in those terms. We look at what are the people's experience and what are because the people are experts on their own experience. How can we connect with community and develop policy ideas that reflect their experiences and come up with real solutions that address them? And then to speak to a major research project we're working on right now. Last week, you know, we had the privilege of going down to Rochester and reporting back to them, a group of formerly incarcerated folks and people who work within the criminal legal system who gave us input on our research around cash bail. So today in Minnesota, if you are arrested for a crime, accused of a crime, you sit in jail until they give you a bail hearing. Innocent or guilty, you're going to sit there unless you can pay your cash bail to get out. Those who can pay get to go home. For single mothers and or fathers or whomever who can't afford to pay, they sit there. And regardless if they're a danger to the community or not. Meanwhile, someone who is a danger, and this often happens where someone, you know, you got a little dope money in the speaker box or whatever, can pay their bail, get out, and go back to doing what they was doing. We want to change the system. After our research, we learned that there's a better way to facilitate that process. So if we're going to suspend your liberties, we should have a process that thinks about, are you going to show up to court? And if we let you out of jail, are you going to kick up dust? So can we make sure you're going to be safe when you leave jail? And can we make sure you come back to address whatever crimes you've been accused of? And can we provide services to help people do that? The data shows if you send someone a text message, it's a lot more effective than the bail bondsman to get you to show up. And so we have a whole report, a body of work on this that people are welcome to read at mnjrc.org. Last week, we introduced a constitutional amendment to eliminate cash bail from our constitution, because when it was written, it said all offenses are bailable. And so the constitutional amendment won't eliminate cash bail, but what it will do is allow us to pass bills that are constitutional so that we can replace the current system with one that is more safer, more equitable, and respects our liberties.
Yeah, awesome.
That's what I got.
Great, great, great. I'm Al McFarland. This is The Conversation with Al McFarland. And we're talking about community. And the framing of this conversation really has to do with understanding what are and how are they organize the legacy institutions that serve our community. And leading that discussion is our colleague and friend, Marquita Stevens. She's the president and CEO of Urban League of Twin Cities. And Marquita, let me have you, if you would, talk about what the Urban League of Twin Cities is doing right now that nobody else can do. And how would our community be harmed if the Urban League and institutions like it did not exist? I'll go a little further. How does the Urban League stay relevant across generations while honoring its founding mission? And, you know, kind of what's at stake? I'll ask Anthony and Justin to weigh in on what's at stake for young people that are looking at the institution, the Urban League of Twin Cities. And what does the data say, Justin, about institutional presence and community outcomes? At the end of the day, this is not just about a nonprofit. The Urban League is a nonprofit. This is really about community infrastructure. Marquita, what do you think?
I think you said that rather well. I think we're doing what we were created to do. I think that the purposes for which we are created, that we continue to serve, are still crucial to the health of the community. It's interesting you asked that, because I asked my staff about what makes us distinctive. Why do people choose to come to us for, let's just say, workforce or employment services? Why are our time slots full with people coming to us? Because they do have other choices. Mm-hmm. And the answer that they give me time after time after time is that they trust us, that they can tell their story without fear of reprimand, without fear of shame, and they can leave whole. And that goes a lot farther than just getting a job. And so people want to be whole. They want, and the indicators of those things are the things we talked about: job, housing, food, you know, et cetera. those are the indicators, but the feeling inside along the path toward those things come from having a community of people that believe in you and knowing what to say, how to say it, and to be that voice that they need in their lives that seems to draw them back time after time after time. I meet people all the time. When I bought a car a couple of years ago, the guy who sold it to me got services from the Urban League. I don't know, 20, 30 years ago. He was going through a bad time. He went to the Urban League. The Urban League helped him get on his feet. He's been moving forward ever since. He still remembers what the Urban League does, and we do that. We did that then. We do that now. So we're the grandma, and no community can do without the grandmas.
Let me add to that. You know, I may have mentioned this to you earlier when we talked, but Insight is a major beneficiary of the services organized by the Minneapolis Urban League. When I started Insight back in the 70s, I think, or early 80s, you know, things were difficult. Economies were up and down, but mostly down. And the atmosphere for creating and growing a Black business was always bleak, always difficult. One of the things that sustained us in one of those difficult times was the Urban League led and managed program called MEED. It was M-E-E-D or M-E-A-D. I think it stood for Minnesota Economic and Employment Development. I'm not sure of the acronym, but I am sure of what it did. What it did was allow me to hire probably 7-8 people over a period of time with their salaries subsidized as part of a training and investment opportunity. And those people I paid, and I was reimbursed for the salaries I paid to them. But these are people that I could not have afforded otherwise, and they sustained us and helped us grow. And I think I mentioned to you earlier in the year, Marquita, when we talked, wouldn't it be wonderful if the Urban League could also re-inject that kind of support to businesses, such as the ones that Anthony is talking about developing in North Minneapolis, where there is support to bring on, to train and develop, and allow people to make those incomes, the $55,000 income they need to be in a sustainable situation. So Urban League has, among other things, always been a powerful organization for providing direct services around economic development. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that you're pivoting, among other things, into foster care. Talk about that and why is that important? And you mentioned that your personal background has also placed you in a position of knowledge about foster care. So talk about why that pivot makes sense for the Urban League right now. And in the context of how do we look at the problems that beset our community as opportunities for advancement, development, that solution making ought to be a business in and of itself. What do you think? Are you able to hear me? Marquita, did you get that?
I think she's frozen now.
I think so. Maybe her, you know. Yeah. But Anthony, I mentioned you. Jump in. You know, talk about that.
You know, I think this is actually a moment for reflection on this, honestly. Mm-hmm. I think that the Urban League is really interesting because it really was around 100 years ago. I believe that, and I know that historically, mutual aid organizations were fundamentally self-funded. I mean, they were deeply connected to community in terms of the work that they were doing. And so the early mutual aid for Black institutions were really driven by the churches, the informal neighboring networks. It was informal economic orientation. It was the growth of this. And so they became bridge organizations instead of the organizations that they are now. And this is a very difficult moment. They emerge, and then what happens is the welfare state emerges. The Great Depression. Then we wind up with the from that moment comes the Great Society. And so what happens is we shift from mutual aid, direct connection to people. people to something that is a little bit different, which is the professionalization of what we now call the nonprofit community. So the work that you're talking about is really the state's work or the city's work or the county's work that is contracted with organizations and community to do the work. So it's that's what I would say is precarious. The truth of the matter is the nonprofit community is the biggest institution in North Minneapolis. I think I would almost like to begin to turn it around and go, we need to acknowledge that the professionalization of the nonprofit organizations beginning in the 70s or 80s, whenever they started, created an industry. It is the number one industry. And when we were talking North Point is the largest employer in North Minneapolis, mm-hmm. right? Which mm-hmm. fundamentally is a nonprofit. So there's something around the work that we have to do where we have to continue to deliver the service and the work and the programs and see ourselves and see the organizations in a little bit different light. And I'm not, again, this is just me looking at the moment. This is an opportunity as we make this transition. The struggle for our organizations that are doing social support is that the federal government is mad at Minnesota. Right. That right now, every organization is suffering from the implications of fraud, we'll say. Right. You know, and so this is really a very interesting moment for us. And what I'm saying, you know, that's what I'm saying. And my mother founded a brilliant nonprofit, what I'm very proud of. And simultaneously, I have to build something on the for-profit side so that we are more free around the decisions we make. We actually need to organize for Marquita. She needs to be able to organize $500,000 of Black infusion of capital in her organization. The freedom of that is unquestionable. And it's a really interesting moment for us to think about that because we are there once again. That's when in 1910, that's what we were realizing. And in 1910, the growth of the Black insurance business, it is, we need to go back and look at that. The Black insurance business into the 60s was a monumental funder of efforts and investments. And so there's a way for we have to look at it like that. And our business, our number one business, cannot be social support. That's a challenge for us. And so let me push back,
Anthony, because I hear my grandma's voice. Me growing up in Kansas City, I used to walk around with a cardboard box with a string around it, right? And in the box I had these sweet potato pies. They were the small size, like maybe this size, big around. Yep. And yep. I go to door-to-door selling. And that's my beginning in entrepreneurship. But my grandmother always told me, boy, mind your business. Mind your business. And what is your business? Well, we were in the church business at the time. My grandfather was a pastor. And she told me, I'm not sure she said it or if I just deduced this from the conversation, that the biggest business on the planet is God's business. That's number one. Number two, mind your business. Well, what if I said, you know, what I read in the papers every day and hear on the news is about the health disparities that beset our community. We are victims of public policy and processes that enable and, in a sense, almost nurture the illness and the lack of health and the lack of wealth in our community. And it's not for our benefit, but that our benefit creates a well for the nurturing of other communities outside of our community. So what if we change that around? And this is my tribute to the nonprofits and say that our business is our health, our economy, our wellness. It's not an either or. I'm looking at Rochester, Minnesota. What if North Minneapolis, North Point, Urban League, MEDA, that collection, UROC, of agencies, organizations, absolutely. Could you mobilize could. Research, data, service, and solutions for the public, for the individual good and the public good, and in the process, create a flow of millions, but billions of dollars that enrich us individually who are doing the work. What do you think? Marquita, you first, and then Anthony, come back to it.
That's what I'm saying. I reverse that order and have Anthony go first.
Well, go ahead.
Then,
I think the thing that I'm saying, Al, is that Mayo Clinic is fundamentally a for-profit institution that actually channels those resources towards the goals of that community, right? Yeah. Or however you look at it. And what I'm saying is that our community, that growing the businesses that are led by Black Voice and making Black choices around the way that we use our profits really is critical. I think just as the health element you talk about, their outcomes as well. I don't disagree with you that the systemic march against Black people is real. That's not my challenge. What I am saying is that there is a way where we have to look at the partnership between the organizations that are doing social support and mutual aid and those that are generating revenue on the other side and the way that we make decisions. Because we have to do all those things. We have to do policy, right? We have to do social support, and we have to build economic engines that are growing for us, and especially in communities where we are relatively small, right? I mean, it's a really interesting piece of it, and your grandmother was probably right about all of our businesses. God is our first business, but the truth of the matter that I would say, what I believe at that moment in time is that the church and the role that it played around social cohesion, around building identity, around directing the efforts and conscience of the community, was a really big deal, and I think that is how they go together. I don't agree. I mean, I agree with you that they're not separate, either or. But there is an over focus on one side of the ledger, and I am saying we have to bring it back into balance.
Can I jump in here real quick, Al?
Of course.
So I think, you know, per usual, Minnesota Black folks, like, we're pretty polite. You know, maybe it's the Minnesota nice thing, but I think it's just would be helpful to just to say the what we need to say a lot. Like, for the conditions in our community, especially in Minnesota, are facilitated, right? So if you think about it, you know, the violence, the economic struggle, all of these things are facilitated. And what you find, it's not like there's an evil white man behind a curtain pulling a lever, but I'm saying if you, like, every vote at the legislature is documented. So you had to create a paper.
His name ain't Donald.
Well, he ain't hiding behind nothing, right?
He's not behind the curtain. He's out front. That's right.
But to bulldoze Rondo, like, there is a vote count on that. There is research and studies that showed how that decision was made. And so my first reaction to what you were suggesting, Al, is that as if we haven't always tried to build more economic excellence in our community, as if we haven't tried to use the Urban League used to do the report on the state of Black America or Black Minnesotans used to be, you know, as rooted with leaders from our community like Ella Baker, right? Like, they have always been about building power and pushing back. The service model comes in later once, you know, the conditions in our community have been deteriorated so much that now we are reliant on a model that is handed to us. Like, they have never stopped deconstructing what we have been trying to build from day one. Am I making sense? So you build Rondo, it gets bulldozed. You build the Urban League, well, now it needs to become a service model. Like, these are not, like I'm saying, there isn't like one evil white man making this happen.
So you build Rondo, yeah, gets bulldozed. You build Rosewood. You build Black Wall Street, you build Nicodemus, you build all these things.
All of that is real. And that's what I'm saying, right? But that was what I was saying. It all was constructed. We were on a very clear model towards this idea of building the economy based on, right, in a real way. And that's all I'm saying. So that's what I'm saying. We are back there again, where we need to do that again with a very concerted focus. And we need to build it to a level that we can create the independent ability to fund what the Urban League wants to do.
I agree. Can I ask you a question? I'm sorry. Can I ask you a question again? Here's my concern as an old school organizer is, how do you protect that? Because the instincts of America, I'm not talking about any one individual group or one person, right, or any political persuasion, The instincts of America is that as soon as you start that, Anthony, it will be targeted, dismantled systemically without regret or even an apology. Since, I mean, we went through it this week, the Voting Rights Act, the seminal piece of legislation from the civil rights movement, completely dismantled now. And so I don't disagree with you, but the question I'm asking is, how do we protect it? Because I think this is the one area where Black folks need to spend more time thinking, how do we build the power to protect what we build?
You're right, but it is power, right? That's it. And you know what? We have to realize in some weird way that a Black version of capitalism might be a problem too.
Absolutely.
Right? So that's what I'm saying. And so we have to bring our lived experience to this in such a way that we are clear. Right? That we're clear that idea. And the way we do it is a challenge. And what we have to do is bring what you're describing, our lived experience, to creating the policy. And it's going to be, and we have to get in for the long run. Because it is, you're right. This, what's happening at the federal level is crazy.
Can I take a shot at it?
I would just say that, first of all, the Urban League, at least in the last few years that I've been running it, we have put some emphasis on earned income because there is a decreasing level of support from particularly from foundation community for general operating support. We can typically find program funding for the most part. But general operating funds is very hard to come by and is getting harder. So our struggle is around that. And that's where some of what I think it was you, Justin, who mentioned about the Black elite that is in the Twin Cities being able to contribute to organizations like ours to provide that general operating fund in order to keep services running. We own our building, so in order to keep the building, you know, in shape, that takes general operating fund, you know, and that's where the difficulty comes in. And we have to look to the Black community and their attitude toward agencies like ours to find the answer, you know. It's a, for lack of a better word, cliquish environment, and you can't sustain yourself in that environment. So there has to be a retooling, a re-understanding, a reimagining of what it is we want this community to be. What is it that we want to? What kind of options do we want our children to be raised in? What kind of community options need to exist in order for our kids to survive, learn, grow, et cetera. Because everybody, you know, even though people live in perhaps areas that are defined economically, they will come into contact with and have to engage with people that are not of that same economic community. And they need to learn how to do that. They need to have an attitude that allows them to engage without putting off those whom they are engaging. That's learned. And it gets practiced in places like the Urban League because we draw from so many different places. So individuals that take advantage of, I'm going to just say the Black gyms, is the high school where we pull kids from everywhere. And we do that intentionally because the premise is when you go out to work or to school, you're not going with your crew, you're going by yourself. And you're going to engage with people from everywhere and all walks of life. And you need to understand how you fit in that, in the world. And so you bring together kids from everywhere, of varying economic backgrounds, and they practice that. That's social and emotional development. We need to do more of that. We need to prepare folks for the world ahead. We're faced with this craziness, this crazy environment based on, you know, that this law has pulled the lid off of. This Supreme Court ruling has just pulled the lid off of. It's always been there. It's not new. It's emboldened folks, whether they call themselves MAGA or whatever. They have taken the language of anti-racism and turned it into white grievance. So the other day it came to me that some, you know, white guy, 60-ish, thinks that having a black Santa Claus is racist.
I'm sorry, say that again. The what?
Yeah, you heard me right. A black Santa Claus is racist.
Yeah, mercy.
Yeah. I was like, oh, I'm so glad I wasn't there. I'm glad this was secondhand information.
I think I heard about that, actually. Yeah.
The logical extension of that argument
has just been, I mean, they have taken the language of anti-racism and turned it into white grievance.
The logical extension of that logic, or that statement, is that black life itself is racist.
Yeah.
And we know that what the intent of the current, in my view, policy and practice system coming out of Washington and the MAGA right, the white supremacist platform, is erasure of black people. So let me do a couple of things here. Jared's going to put up an article by this week's issue of Insight News. And if you want to read it, go to insightnews.com or go to issue, ISSUU, .com/Insight News. Jared, if you would, put that in the chat so people that are hearing or watching can pull this up. And a couple of stories I want to call your attention to. The lead story is the Supreme Court's Voting Rights Act. And in that particular article, it's a major issue. Let me pull my notes down on that. One second here. Let me get my notes here. So that story examines the Supreme Court's April 29th ruling regarding Louisiana's congressional districts, and it significantly alters the interpretation of the Voting Rights Act. So the ruling is a 6-3 decision, with a conservative majority striking down a map that included a second black majority district in Louisiana. So while the court technically upheld Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which prohibits discriminatory voting practices, it introduced a new, narrower interpretation for its application based on historical developments. What does that mean? Well, the key arguments from the majority, Justice Samuel Alito wrote that drawing the second district was an unconstitutional gerrymander. The new interpretation makes it more difficult for plaintiffs to challenge redistricting plans in the future. On the dissenting side, Justice Elena Kagan argued that the decision effectively completes the demolition of the Voting Rights Act, making it nearly impossible to use race as a factor in redistricting to ensure racial equality in elections. And what are the major implications? Well, for the 2026 midterm elections, this ruling could lead to more partisan gerrymandering, as states may now find it easier to reduce voting power of minority communities. There's a political shift. Analysts suggest that changing the interpretation of Section 2 could significantly benefit Republicans, with some estimates suggesting the Democrats could lose up to 19 House seats if similar redistricting occurs across the country. And then there's more. And then we have an article that personalizes that on page 4 of the same edition. Jared, you can flip the page if you would. It's an article by our columnist, Haley Taylor Schlitz. And that article, again, personalizes this, so you see the impact Haley is an attorney. She was formerly on the staff of AG Keith Ellison. She's now in with a corporate practice right now. But she reflects in her article called The Weight of April 29th on the significance of that date in her own life. She said it marks the anniversary of her grandfather's unsolved murder during the 1992 Rodney King civil unrest in Los Angeles. So she described this as an inherited empty chair, a wound that shapes her family's history, highlighting that Black families often become keepers of truth that legal systems failed to answer. And the convergence is that she's connecting this personal loss to the Supreme Court's April 29th, 2026 decision in Louisiana versus Calais, which weakened Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. The shift, she says, is that the court didn't erase the law, but made it more dangerous by requiring higher proof of intentional discrimination. The impact, she writes, is that it makes it harder to challenge gerrymandered maps that hide racial balance behind data or political explanations. And so the themes here, law versus justice. She emphasizes that for Black families, the law is not abstract. It is about whether the system accepts responsibility for the pain that they experience or leaves them with what she described as unanswered losses. She also talks about memory as resistance. She rejects the idea of moving quickly to reconciliation without accountability. For her, remembering these dates is an active act of resistance against a system that asks Black Americans to trust institutions that have historically failed to protect them. Anthony, jump in here. You and Justin on the research, talk about the meaning and the impact, both in the global sense of the Voting Rights Act and what it sort of holds for us in terms of what strategies we need to protect ourselves. As Marquis was saying, how do we protect, or as you were saying, justice, how do we protect ourselves and continue to prosper, to thrive, to grow?
I have three very specific things. So first, and Anthony's alluded to this, Marquita's alluded to this, but we just need to say it out loud. We need to build Black independent political power. If you look at how politics works in the state, there are all these organizations that advocate in the interest of their own folks. And on page 6 of the same article, you have the UBLA agenda, and I would argue that the United Black Legislative Agenda, which I was a part of those conversations when they started at the Urban League years ago, that needs to be beefed up. It needs to be resourced. There needs to be organizers. We need to have regular patterns of leaders and community members in our community coming together in a much more strategic way to identify how to advocate and specifically protect the things that we aim to build for our own people. Number two is not going to surprise anybody. We have to reimagine the criminal legal system. And let me just be clear about why I think this matters. One, it was the judiciary, the Supreme Court, that made this decision last week. That is part of the criminal legal system. We need those systems to be aligned with what we're trying to build. So we have to continue to empower our people to go to law school and advocate and part of the system. We need more Charlie Adams running precincts in the city. We need more folks in the criminal legal system advocating with our interests in mind. I got to remind folks that the DOJ, the Department of Justice, was founded with one primary goal: to investigate and prosecute the KKK. That's the only reason we got some relief during Reconstruction, is because we had the Department of Justice's first assignment was to take on white domestic terrorism and protect Black folks. Obviously that mission ain't last, but I'm saying that it was a smart strategy. And I think we need to look at the criminal legal system and figure out how we can reimagine it in a way that will protect Black folks instead of targeting Black folks. And then the third is something that I hope nobody rolls their eyes at, because we got to start taking it serious. But speaking of the DOJ and Reconstruction, there's been several groups in this country that have gotten reparations. White slave owners got reparations after the failure of Reconstruction. You're talking about there are Native Americans who deserve far more, but have gotten reparations. You're talking about all Asian Americans who have gotten reparations. But for some reason, that conversation stops when it comes to us. And then they look at our community and they say, what's wrong with y'all? What's wrong with y'all is that the resources, that the sweat and blood that we dropped in the soil in this country to build this nation has never been repaid to us. And as a matter of fact, you have built your wealth. Wall Street was a slave auction block. The wealthiest capital, the wealth capital in the world, was a slave auction block. And I know where my people come from. So I can tell you that my family has been robbed of specific resources. And so unless we have Black independent political power, unless we reimagine a criminal legal system that does its job to protect the rights of the people afforded to the rights afforded to the people by the US Constitution. And by the way, don't get me started on that, because we need to reimagine that too, but that's a whole nother conversation. And third, we need to actually run a serious data-informed conversation about reparations. We don't even have to go back to slavery. My mama deserves reparations from the discrimination she faced going into corporate America. And so it's like it's just time that we start thinking, spending a lot more time with each other, trying to create space where we can reimagine things together. And I'm gonna say this, I'll be quiet, is just that it's not like the nation doesn't need it. You know, like, they continue to try to test our community as though we're going to bring another Malcolm X or Martin Luther King. That's what this white supremacist movement in our country is most afraid of. And we need to evolve our tactics because, you know, my son's name is Booker, because I disagree profusely with W.E.B. Du Bois, and that there is no talented tent in our community. All of our people are talented. And I want to be clear that it's time we start acting like that and build power structures that protect us, target the criminal legal system so that we know we have an enforcement mechanism for constitutional rights, and then advocate for a serious reparations campaign that will actually infuse capital across the country that will benefit everybody, but will for once allow America to reckon with its original sin, which is how it's treated our people from day one.
Anthony, what do you think?
Well, I think this is one thing I will say that I would say, you know, the decision was 6-3, which that alone is a really big deal, right? It was 6-3. It wasn't 5-4, you know. So the other thing I would say is that this what this ruling does is that it really it prohibits any voting practice that denies or abridges the right to vote on account of race or color, and it bars maps that give racial minority less opportunity than others. I mean, we have to read into it, and this intent requirement is a challenge for us, right? The intent, and that's what this is saying, the intent or strong inference, right, to create a racially organized map is a challenge related to Black people. That's what they're using it for. But it is not provable when they're organizing it around Republicans who tend to be white. I mean, you know, we just in a really strange space with it. So I think our opportunity is we are going to fight this at a national level. We will have the Urban League, you know, NAACP. There's a national organization of Black organizations, including the ACLU, that will get to work on that. Where I am aligned, Justin, with you directly, and I think Marquita, with the work that you do as the Urban League directly, is we've got to localize locally. We can do the work at the state level. We can do the work at the city level. That the way that we vote and who we vote for is really important. So we have to double down on the right to vote. We have to double down where we actually do have agency and control. And so it requires us to do this at a deeper level locally, right? And be engaged more locally and understand where we put our energy relative to this. So I really want to bring it back to what we can do in this market, in this city, in this county, in this state, so that our votes do count where they matter, and that we actively support the right policy and we support the right institutions. And I do believe that Urban League is an organizing principle relative to that work that we're doing.
Yes, certainly.
This is the conversation with Al McFarland. We're going to continue. Our guest today, Marquita Stevens, CEO of the Urban League of Twin Cities. You just heard Anthony Taylor, who's an entrepreneur, organizer in community, a businessman, and also Justin Terrell of the Minnesota Justice Research Center. You know, go ahead, Marquita. Now, I want to expand the conversation. You mentioned the Southern Poverty Law Center. That's our lead story on the cover of this week's Inside News. I want to talk about that and the Minnesota connection there in just a second. But Marquita, go ahead.
What I want to bring us to is what I consider the fundamental issue, and that is the relationship between what we do and who we are. And I think that's what we're looking at when we look at the Supreme Court decision and what led up to it and how quickly it's been embraced in terms of implementing change in the southern states with the voting lines, et cetera. And it, we cannot afford to only focus on what was done. We have to focus on who did it, who we are. Who we are drives what we do. And we are moving back to shedding that which we have bred within society to make us more humane, to make us more tolerant, to make us more loving, et cetera. We're shedding that. And the 2025 agenda is on full display in this behavior. And we have to understand that we're not just going after the shiny red ball, the things that they do. You have to deal with who they are. And if you don't hit them there, you're always going to be jumping around, running after all of the things that they do. So we're going to have to change the, not change, we're going to have to include in the conversation that aspect of it, because it's producing people to say Black Santa Claus is racist. Mm-hmm. So we're moving back toward a society that does not appear to be ashamed of its racism. And that's different for this current generation.
Anthony, what do you think? I think you're muted, Anthony.
There you go. Yeah.
You got about 30 seconds.
I will say I certainly agree with that, but I'm right now meditating on the decision of the first freed African-American people who made a dedicated decision to stay here, to lean into the Constitution and try to hold this country accountable to what it had written, and that we may be the group that challenges what happened. And there's a path forward led by us.
Justin, 30 seconds.
If we don't do what Anthony's talking about, then I don't think the nation survives.
Like, exactly.
In the story, you can't build a nation on freedom and constitutional rights and behave as we have for the last 250 years plus and expect things to work out.
So what I didn't do is get into the question of the article, our lead story on the Southern Poverty Law Center. I'll take about a minute and invite you listeners and viewers to go to insightnews.com and read the story, or go to what's on the screen there, issue.com, Insight News. It's our cover story. And the story examines the federal indictment of the Southern Poverty Law Center, which faces 11 counts, including wire fraud and money laundering. The government alleges that the organization used donor funds to pay secret informants who infiltrated white supremacist groups like the KKK and Aryan Nation, disguising the payments through fictitious business entities. What the indictment doesn't do, the article says, is that it deliberately ignores a crucial fact, and that is that the SPLC, Southern Poverty Law Center, reportedly shared the intelligence gathered by these informants with the FBI. And by framing the case as financial fraud, the government avoids addressing the SPLC's role in uncovering domestic terrorism threats, such as those prior to the 2017 Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville. This article also suggests that the broad frame is used as a tool to dismantle civil rights infrastructure. Well, we'll come back to that because there's a companion piece, a sidebar, that talks about what happened specifically in Minnesota and the Feeding Our Future Welfare Fraud case. And it says what happens when the financial investigation expands into a massive immigration enforcement campaign, and what it happens when it is used as a cover to defund or destroy legacy Black institutions. We'll come back to all of that. This has been a wonderful conversation. Marquita Stevens, thank you for your leadership, your service, for the work you do with the Urban League of Twin Cities. Brother Anthony Taylor and Brother Justin Terrell, thank you both for your work. I'm Al McFarland. This is The Conversation with Al McFarland. We'll see you next week. Have a great day.
And this is Community Radio. It's KFAI 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and St. Paul. Online and archived at kfai.org.